Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is China at the Crossroads. It is my pleasure to introduce Peter Liu, who will be our moderator. Peter is the founder and vice chairman of New Resource Bank, which creates new standards in banking services while promoting green and sustainable resources. Peter serves on the boards of the China-U.S. Energy Efficiency Alliance, the Climate Action Fund, and has also served as a Clean Technology Investment Advisory Board member to the California Public Employees Retirement Fund and the California Teachers Retirement Fund, which are the two biggest funds in the world, right?
They were, and hopefully still are.
Right. Yes, and that is my personal hope, by the way. That's why I invited Peter tonight. I'm kind of dependent on his advice to the committee, to the both retirement funds. Peter will introduce our panel members who are active on the ground day-to-day at the Natural Resources Defense Council's Beijing office in China and advisory to the office in our NRDC's U.S. offices. So we're very pleased to have them here with us in their travels this month between China and the United States. So again, they have been there now for over 13 years working with the community and community leaders, and they will give us their up-to-date experiences and observations and comments about what they think is coming in the future in China from their work day-to-day with community leaders and communities. So, Peter, welcome, and panel, welcome, and we're looking forward to tonight's discussion.
Great. Thank you, Anne. It's a real pleasure to be here to participate in this very important topic. As a banker, I love talking about the real economy. The real economy is where we make things, grow things, and this issue of China at the crossroads is at the heart of the real economy for the world for the 21st century. There is a new business idiom that goes as follows. China is now the factory for the world. I'm going to test this idiom. If there's a member of the audience who don't possess right now, that you're highly confident of, anything that's made in China, please raise your hand. So for the listening audience, there is no hands up. So China is indeed the factory of the world. They make the cell phones, the clothes, and the knickknacks that we all use on a daily basis. China, through that factory role, is also making something else. It is now the largest emitter, along with the United States, the largest consuming nation of global warming gases. In fact, both China and the U.S. emit about 20% each. However, China could have been today emitting 40% of the world's emissions if it did not achieve a certain goal that it set for itself from 1980 to 2000, which is to quadruple its economy while only doubling its energy use. So it was able to grow a unit of GDP by using only half a unit of energy. That's a wonderful achievement, but beyond the sort of global warming impacts of carbon emissions, China can't really be left out of the conversations of other issues like dwindling global natural resources, energy security for all of us, and then also regional and transoceanic pollution. We are indeed, as Anne said, very fortunate today to be able to get a holistic view of China at this crossroads. It's inevitable that China is going to grow its economy. However, what does that mean in terms of energy, the environment, and the associated climate change impact from that path? We have three experts today from the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is one of the world's leading environmental organizations, to give us both a policy and also on the ground, and in fact, in some ways, personal experience and expertise on this topic. And I want to take this time to first introduce our panels, and then I will open with a general question for each of the panelists, and then follow that with questions that perhaps we can hear from each of the panelists, and then finally to let the audience have a chance to ask our expert some of their thoughts. So our first panelist is Felicia Marcus. Felicia is the NRDC's Western Director, but previously she had served as the Regional Administrator for the EPA, and she's also served as a Senior Manager at the Trust for Public Land. As an environmental leader in the United States, she has had a long-standing personal and professional interests in China, beginning with her studies and then continuing through engagements with Chinese delegations and also through her work as an expert trainer in China. Our second panelist is Barbara Fenimore. Since 1996 and following her work with the United Nations on China's first sustainability plan, Barbara undertook the challenge of establishing the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC's first international office ever in Beijing, and building that office into a real leading platform where they provide legal, technical, economic, and policy expertise to both the Chinese government and the private sector. Today, Barbara is recognized worldwide for her ongoing environmental leadership and groundbreaking work in China. And our third panelist is Gao Jie. Gao joined NRDC after serving as a judge in Beijing, so she really knows the inner workings of the Chinese legal systems. Having attended law schools in both the U.S. and China, Gao has a really wide view and a bilateral or multilateral view, really, of how to address transboundary environmental change issues, and amongst other things, is working to establish a system of public interest litigation in China, which has been a foundation for environmental progress in this country. Also in the audience is another member of the NRDC China team, Alex Wong. So we're very well represented by this wonderful organization. So I want to launch right into our discussion after hearing such distinguished backgrounds of the people who will be doing the speaking. And I want to address this to Alicia, to Felicia. As the Western Director of the NRDC, you have been a senior management member of U.S.-based major environmental organizations. Why is China so important to the NRDC's efforts? Is China a linchpin to especially the global climate issues? And do we see them as a risk or as an opportunity?
Right. I thank you, Peter. It's great to have you on the panel. I'm honored to be joining the team from the Beijing office. I think there are a couple of things come to mind when you think about why China would be so important to NRDC, but really to all of us who care about the global environment's interest. And when I thought about it, there were sort of two streams of thought. One was the obvious one, which is need, and the other is opportunity. And when I thought about need, I couldn't help thinking about the old story about what bank robber Willie Sutton said when asked why he robbed banks, and he said, because that's where the money is. So if you were trying to think about global warming, it's where the emissions are and where the people are. So an obvious place where anyone who's interested globally in making a difference has to pay attention. As Peter said, China has just overtaken, really, the U.S. as the largest emitter annually of carbon. And frankly, we can't deal with a problem like global warming without dealing with China in a constructive and effective way. From my perspective, historically, having been a China watcher in an earlier life, there has always been a challenge of how the U.S. has looked at China, how journalists have covered China. And it's always been something of a caricature. There's a lot of literature about it. We could talk about it later if any of you are interested about how American view of China has swung back and forth from a caricature of the Pearl Buck sort of noble peasant people, which was also a caricature of a place, or Fu Manchu and, you know, the Red Peril. And frequently, if you look at how China is viewed in terms of their rhetoric, it's not really very realistic about what's on the ground. So anyone who actually has looked at China for a while knows it is an incredible country with incredible talents and challenges. And so if you look beyond that, you see an incredible opportunity if you look at what's actually happening in China, where their approach and issues dovetail really nicely with what NRDC's approaches have been in California in particular, which many of you have known, which has been to focus on energy in addition to the pollution side of the environmental house, and seeing that beautiful economic and environmental opportunity that comes with promoting energy efficiency and clean and green renewable energies. So there also was a great opportunity to go to China and to merge our interests and really try and make a difference over time. Another incredible opportunity that we had was having Barbara as a longtime NRDC staff person with a history and an interest in China. And she and her energy colleagues really made the case years ago that this really was where NRDC should constructively engage. So that's part of the reason why NRDC saw it as such a great opportunity, in addition to just seeing it as a math problem of the emissions that were out there. I mean, is China a linchpin to action? Yeah, it is. To quote one of our donors that we were talking about this morning, China's really big. I mean, it's obvious. It is. It's the central kingdom. It is the oldest continuous civilization, and it is a key player in solving this problem, and it's a global problem. Without China engaged, also, we can't politically get a bill in China. This is the pragmatic side. And so there's a dovetailing of needing China engage in these efforts, both because we need them to solve the problem, but we also need China engaged for our own domestic political reasons, in a way, so that if you look at the rhetoric that is flying around out there, there's a lot of rhetoric from China about how they won't do anything until we do, which is completely understandable because the United States and Europe and the so-called developed world has created this problem in the first place. And so it is completely understandable for China and India to want to see put ourselves where our mouth is first before stepping forward. So there's a really important place to go to get China to find a way to be most constructive in China, have China be seen as the constructive player on these issues as they are, that Barbara and Peter and Gao Jia can speak about a little bit more. But it has been one of those periods where we've had to explain that it was going to be very important for China to step forward, but that China had a legitimate reason to wait for us. So I had a whole talk prepared here where I was going to really explain why that was so important. And then President Hu last week totally blew my talk by coming out ahead and committing China to more aggressive action on China than we expected him to do this early. And he and Barbara can explain it in more detail, but he really talked about reducing China's carbon intensity, which doesn't mean setting a number for an exact target yet, but that the amount of energy expended per unit of domestic economic growth would be smaller, which is very significant. He said it would be notable, and that is, I would take it in my old China Watcher days as being a kind of big word. Notable is big, and significant, and also a huge commitment to renewables and energy efficiency, which we thought was good. And so we can talk a little bit more about why that might have happened early. I suspect a piece of it is to help nudge U.S. action ahead as we're debating our climate bill. But that was really pretty exciting. And I can talk about, I want to move on to the other people.
Sure,
and talk about whether it's a risk or opportunity.
Why don't we also, just for now, stay on the President Hu theme, which is, yes, he sounds like he did say something very encouraging, yet unspecified, and there's nuances in the choice of words. So Barbara, you've been in China for decades. So are you encouraged by those nuanced words? How has pronouncements translated in action in your experience? And both looking backwards in your experience and also looking forwards, what's going to be the keys to success?
Thank you, Peter, and thanks to all of you for coming here tonight to hear from us. President Hu's announcement last week, for those of you who have followed it, was notable in and of itself, because it was the first time that China had agreed to adopt a climate-related topic target, which is to reduce its carbon intensity by a notable margin. Now, it's also significant who made this remark and this commitment. It was the president. And it's significant where he made this statement. It was at the UN Global Climate Summit and before the Copenhagen agreements. So you all know that when China makes a statement like this on the international stage, it's going to do everything in its power to meet it. And the only question, of course, is what's the target going to be? That was missing. And so it's very encouraging to us that China has adopted a carbon intensity target, which is to us a step further than its current target of reducing its energy intensity per unit of GDP by 20% between 2005 and 2010. It's significant because a carbon intensity target includes other things such as renewable energy as well as energy efficiency. And, of course, President Hu's statement also pledged to achieve a 15% share of renewables and nuclear energy in its overall energy mix by 2020 and to take other actions such as reducing its rate of deforestation and upping its investment in clean technology. And I would note that China is 3 years into its current energy intensity target, and it has already made significant progress. We estimate that in the 3 years of the five-year target that have passed so far, China has already achieved about a 10% improvement in its energy intensity per unit of GDP. That may not seem like much, but it also already translates into hundreds of millions of tons of CO2 reduction. And just like the energy intensity target, we expect the carbon intensity target to be included in China's upcoming five-year plan, the 12th five-year plan, which will cover the period from 2011 to 2015. And I'd be interested to hear my colleague Gaojia's views on this, but it's been my experience that targets that are included in the five-year plan are enforced often much more aggressively than the law itself, whether it be environmental laws or energy laws, which are very progressive in China. And there's one, at least, shall I say, in the current five-year plan. That was not the case in previous five-year plans. The last one, for example, the 10th five-year plan, had a very aggressive target for reduction of sulfur dioxide, which is the main ingredient in acid rain, which is covering at least one-third of China's land area and causing untold damage to public health and to its agricultural output. The target in the 10th five-year plan was to reduce SO2 emissions by 20% between 2000 and 2005. But when the time came to measure how well that target had been achieved, it was found that SO2 emissions instead went up by 27%. This period, 2000 to 2005, was the fastest growth rate for coal-fired power plants in China's history, and in fact led China to overtake the U.S. in annual CO2 emissions by approximately 2006. It's key to understand, though, why was it that that target in the 10th five-year plan was not met and the energy efficiency target in the current five-year plan is well on its way to being achieved. And we believe there's one key difference, and that is that after it announced the current five-year plan, China also changed the system by which the provincial government leaders and the leaders of all its major factories or enterprises are rated on their job performance. For decades, they were rated on one metric only. Who can guess what it is? That's right. How well they grew their provincial or factory GDP, economic output. And boy, they were good at it, better than anybody else. Well, in the current system, China now has ruled that these officials and factory owners will be rated in part by how well they achieve the targets for energy intensity reduction and also some emission reductions, again for SO2 and other pollutants, in the current five-year plan. That is human nature. If your job is on the line, if your chances for promotion or bonus are rated on how well you cut the energy use in your factory, when it clearly saves you money, same at the provincial level, well, by golly, you're going to do that. And that's what we're seeing. And so I am fully confident that China will do everything in its power to achieve whatever carbon intensity target it sets. But we're back to the original question of what will that target be? And we believe that, in part, it was a negotiation tactic on the part of China's leadership not to choose and or announce a specific number, because they would like to wait and see what the United States and other countries are going to bring to the table in the international climate negotiations. And in particular, is the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress going to pass a meaningful climate law? And also, what types of financial and technical assistance is the developed world going to provide to China and other developing countries? So I think we're going to probably have to wait until the last minute of the negotiations at the Copenhagen talks or beyond before we see an actual number. But I think it's important also to note that China has strong reasons of its own to adopt a carbon intensity reduction target. And the first and most important reason is coal. Coal is responsible for 80% of China's electricity and 80% of its CO2 emissions. But it's also the largest source of every kind of air pollution in China, responsible for thousands of deaths, illnesses, hospital visits, damage to agriculture, productivity, and so forth. It also is a leading contributor to China's water pollution and industrial waste. And so this has become a major concern to China, and it's been estimated by a recent report called The True Cost of Coal that if you add up all the costs of environment and health costs of coal to China's economy, it approximates more than 7% of its GDP. Well, that sounds awful close to their annual GDP growth rate. So the impacts of China's heavy reliance on coal to power its economic growth is in fact damaging that very economic growth. China also sees a market in clean tech. As you may know, it was the leading, it is growing its renewable energy industry faster than any other country in the world. Its wind power doubled each year for the past 4 years in a row. It's the leading manufacturer of solar photovoltaics. It also leads in biomass, in solar water heaters, and in geothermal, many other types of renewable energy. So China is, of course, developing and wants to become a world leader in the market for electric vehicles. Now, we have found in the U.S. Senate that the senators who are holding out on their votes on the climate bill switch very quickly from argument that China is not doing anything on climate change to, oh, my goodness, China is going to overtake us in the clean tech race and eat our lunch. And so in closing, I'd just like to point out that there is this clean tech market development is not a situation or a commodity like toys or socks. Development of a clean tech market benefits everybody, including U.S. companies and the U.S. economy. We all know how closely intertwined our economy is with China. But here's one example of how closely We are already intertwined in the clean tech market. Many of you may have heard an announcement earlier this month that the Chinese government reached an agreement with a solar company in Phoenix, Arizona, called First Solar, to build the world's largest solar power plant in China. And if completed according to plan, this plant will cover an area of 25 square miles, larger than the island of Manhattan, and will power 3 million homes. This is an opportunity that went to a U.S. company. So it's not, it's much more complex than it may seem about one side winning the clean tech race and others losing. I would say that the clean tech market in China, to answer Peter's question, is important for China's own economy, for its environment, and for the health of its people. It's important. It's an enormous opportunity for U.S. companies that seize the opportunities. And, of course, it's essential for the future of our planet.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, China at the Crossroads, with our distinguished guests, Peter Liu, Felicia Marcus, Barbara Fenimore. Thank you, Barbara, for that wonderful summary. And now Gao Jin.
Yeah, so Gao, we've heard some very compelling arguments, both from international, national level. There's GDP arguments. There's certainly global climate impact arguments. What about the people? I personally do think people matter, and especially when you have 1+ billion people, it especially matters. What do sort of the everyday Chinese think of kind of environmental protection, climate change, and then maybe if you can get even more personal, you know, why did you move from a judge to become an environmental lawyer, and why did you join an American or international organization such as NRDC?
You got all the good questions. I was always asked, you know, the first question is, why do you become an environmental lawyer from a judge? Environmental issues actually is a human issue. Going down, it's always about people. It's out of, you know, how you care your family, how you care your children. I think that's the reason I became a environmental lawyer. I first felt the impulse, felt the instinct to protect my child from the, you know, from the pollutions is when I was pregnant, when I was reading the books prepared for the quasi-mummies. But at that time, I don't know exactly what I could do to deal with these problems. And 1 year later, I attended an environmental law training workshop. It brought China's top law professors, the judges, the environmental agency officials, and also the lawyers from abroad, from United States, from Japan, to teach the Chinese lawyers and judges and how to employ the tool of law to address the environmental issues. And then I'm determined to become an environmentalist. So I moved gradually towards this direction. And 6 years later, I studied environmental law in the States in University of Michigan Law School. And in the textbook, I got to know NRDC. And I got to know how NRDC's work is shaping, has been shaping and enforcing U.S. environmental law. I would like to do the same thing to the people of China and to relieve the concerns of other mothers and fathers in China and outside of China, the rest of the world. So I think this is why I chose to NRDC, and it turned out it's a great choice. I think I am doing what I wanted to do then. These days I've been to San Francisco, but I don't have much time to spend time to go to the Golden Gate Bridge, and for sightseeing, I was busy preparing for a workshop, a training workshop. And it turned out to be exactly the same workshop I attended 6 years ago. This was co-sponsored, co-organized by NRDC China program and a local NGO partner under China's prestigious university. So I think I'm moving towards the right direction. And as to my personal experience to, you know, to other Chinese people, I think I also saw the optimistic changes over the years. This morning during breakfast, I talked with Anne about the plastic, the overuse of plastic bag. And I told Anne that 1 year ago, China's government adopted a policy to ban free supply of plastic bag in all supermarkets, in all retailing sectors. And a survey done by a retailing association, the Retailing Business Association, this June, that's the 1 year anniversary of this policy, showed that 66% of decrease of plastic bag use, which means 40 billions of bags. starting from another small thing, air conditioner. In China, the people now all very know a policy called 60 degrees Celsius, which is the equivalent of 79 Fahrenheit degrees. That means in all the public buildings, the temperature set for the AC could not be lower than this degree. And this was adopted by China's government in 2005. It was initially campaigned by NGOs, but got the fully support and commitment of the government. And going bigger from these small things, the China government is now promoting, or we say the party is promoting, the notion of scientific development outlook. And another notion is called eco-civilization. These are not just empty talking, although many of these party words are empty talking. Because I noticed the Chinese people are really thinking hard how to make these notions down to solid systems to practice to make real difference. One example I want to cite it is the field I'm working on, the public interest litigation field. You know, Guiyang City is economically underdeveloped city in southwest of China. And it is selected by the central government as a pilot city for eco-civilization city. And this city has been making laws, a set of laws and regulations to set up mechanism to achieve eco-friendly development. And one of these is public interest litigation. This system allows the normal citizens, any person, to bring suits to the court against the companies violating the emission standards or the government agencies who doesn't do what they are supposed to do. And we, NRDC China program, I and my colleagues in Beijing are working closely with these agencies, with the courts, with lawyers, NGOs, to promoting these initiatives and try to finally set up a national-wide system to improve the enforcement of law. I think that's really encouraging. And, NGOs are playing a real, real big role in China now. Maybe you can't imagine how many environmental NGOs in China. It's changing really quickly. According to a survey done by MEP, that's the Ministry of Environmental Protection affiliated organization, there are over 1,000 civil groups only working on environmental groups, and that's registered. Plus the unregistered, that could be 10 times of this number. And what they are doing is really amazing. They are talking with the agencies about the issues they haven't been taken care of. They wrote letters to the prime minister to raise his attention to, you know, the local cancer villages suffered from the water pollution, and many of them turned out to be well addressed. And they are they are doing something even more drastically, I think. China's society has been open enough to tolerate evaluation, you know, of the performance of the government by NGOs, or in some sense, it's constructive criticism. I want to note one example. NRDC, China Program, together with a local NGO, we did a project called PITI. And this is the Pollution Information Transparency Index. And in this index, the government of performance on how to enforce the open information law is rated by NGO. And this rating has been published via the mainstream media. And my colleague, Alex Wang, together with the director of another NGO, they were invited by the China Central TV station. This is the biggest state-owned media, and many people call it the party-controlled media, to talk about this project, to share their views and insights, how the government could improve their performance in enforce this open information law. I think these changes are really encouraging. As I first said, environmental issues are always about people. So in this sense, Chinese people are as eager as you all to address the environmental issues, including the conventional pollution and the greenhouse gas.
For our radio audience, again, I want to remind you that we are addressing China at the Crossroads, a Commonwealth Club of California program. And now it's time for our questions. But I did want to comment on something that was said earlier to me as we were beginning tonight in the Gold Room. Richard Harris, one of our very special members at the club, said this was especially important for us to be in the Gold Room because San Francisco was known as Gold Mountain. So here we welcome you to Gold Mountain in the Gold Room. And go forward now, Peter, with our questions,
sure.
Please.
I think Gao just talked about the changing mindsets. Here's a very interesting audience question about mindsets. This question identified that about 4 months ago, one of China's senior leaders stated that the CO2 that is generated from Chinese factories, in fact, shouldn't be on China's account. It should be on the account of those countries that are buying or importing these products. So, Gao, question first, starting with Gao Jie, is do other Chinese people mm-hmm. think that way, that, you know, really, you know, they're just making a product for those people who want to use them, and also for the rest of the panel?
Pardon me? Sorry.
Yeah, so is the CO2...
This is always my problem when I was abroad.
Sure, yeah, and my Chinese terrible. So the question is, the CO2 produced in the factories, from the factories in China,
yes.
Should it be on China's sort of national account for CO2, or should it be that of the countries that are consuming the products? So if you make 1 million iPods and you emit certain amount of emissions from a factory in China, but those iPods are all being bought by Americans, should that CO2 really be Americans' CO2 emissions because we're the ones that are consuming that? Do other Chinese think that way? Because this was a statement made by a senior Chinese governmental leader. As pointed out by audience, I don't have the journalistic confirmation, but it's intellectually, I think, interesting enough to ask that question.
Yeah, this is a challenging question.
Right.
Chinese government has made that, you know, as you said, made that statement. Senior leader made that statement. I think to some extent, it represents some thoughts of the normal Chinese citizen because China has become the factory of the world. I believe some of them will think it that way. But my thought might be different because I think these disputes, you know, as an environmentalist, I think I will look into another way. The world is not divided into China, US, Australia in a natural way. There is no line drawn by the nature. It was drawn by the people. And the nature has its own rule. You know, we all live in, the world is made up of land, ocean, air, river, and we all live under that cycle. And no one of us could get out of that cycle. And this problem, this issue, this global warming issue, we can't address that issue without any of one of these players. And spending time, like finger-pointing each other, doesn't make sense. We need to work together to address this issue, you know, for all of our benefits, for the mutual benefits.
Barbara?
That is indeed a very interesting and challenging question. I think it, number one, illustrates the incredibly intertwined nature of the U.S. and China economies. And I do think it's a way for us in the U.S. to think about this issue in that, indeed, our levels of consumption are in many respects leading to high levels of CO2 emissions from China. I would also say, however, in addition to agreeing with everything that Gaojie just said, that I think, in my understanding, the Chinese government has moved beyond that level of discussion, particularly in the last week. It has made many statements that China is ready to do whatever it can to reduce its CO2 emissions, expects the same from the rest of the world, and wants the Copenhagen negotiations to be a success. I would also point out that in the Bali Action Plan, the last international agreement that all the parties to the Copenhagen Agreement were present for and agreed to, it's not quite accurate to use the term China's account, because there is no commitment by China to an absolute reduction in its CO2 emissions or that of any other developing countries. What, in fact, all the relevant countries of the world agreed to at Bali was that developing countries would adopt nationally appropriate mitigation actions that were coupled with financial and technical assistance from the developed world, and that both the levels of NAMAs, we call them nationally appropriate mitigation actions, and the levels of financial and technical assistance would be monitored, reportable, and verifiable. That's the operative agreement right now. So it doesn't really matter in the long run what levels of CO2 emissions are attributable to China. What matters is what can they do, what will they do to curb the growth of their CO2 emissions and eventually reduce them, and what the developed world can and will do to help.
And we can go on to maybe one follow-up to that, which is, even when we get to targets, accurate reporting is a whole different issue. Do we think China's numbers are accurate? And what do we know about monitoring and verification? Felicia, you've been both on the EPA side of things and then also on the advocacy side. So certainly you've been a watchdog as well as being in the government responsible for those numbers. So do you have any comment or thought about accuracy of reporting?
Interesting, a watchdog, but not a lapdog. I think it's interesting when I was thinking about the earlier question, too, and thinking about I realized I had been in management a little too long when my first thought was what an accounting nightmare that would be to try and figure that out, legitimate or not. I think that accounting and monitoring for pollution inventories or carbon inventories is always challenging. I mean, that is a huge challenge here in the U.S. It's been a challenge in the dialogue about offsets that you have done whole programs on at the Commonwealth Club, where with critiques of the Clean Development Mechanism in the European system versus a more strict accounting program of offsets. I think the whole issue does become a real challenge. It's one of those things where the first step, however, is to figure out what your goal is and figure out how to measure it. I think Barbara talked about the five-year plans, and certainly China has a more robust history of setting sort of numerical targets for things at an industrial, energy, and other levels, and an equal history to ours of either meeting them or saying they've met them and not really meeting them. So it's a hard, not to dodge the question, I think it's a great question and a particularly difficult one to answer, but a huge part of the dialogue around how we create this the infrastructure for dealing with our carbon issues. So if you look at, for example, the dialogue in the U.S., the whole reason why the California Climate Action Registry was started and now the Climate Registry nationally was to try and really spend a lot of time on how you would set up the monitoring and accounting systems to deal with just one element, trading, but also to set with baselines and reductions. And that's been years in the making and controversial, as you have competing registries even in the United States. It is a huge issue for Copenhagen, and people will need to look at how China deals with this issue with the same attention that they're going to need to put the U.S. and every other country under a microscope. And I'll turn it to Barbara for more specifics on what those discussions have been. But I think the one cautionary note I would raise is not to assume that this is going to be more challenging for China than it is for the U.S. in terms of the integrity of the system and the enforcement. It's taken us years in the U.S. to keep fine-tuning our systems, and even when we do the toxic release inventory, every year somebody screams and we have to improve it. So it's a multi-year challenge where hopefully the trading of information that comes from the myriad cooperative agreements and visiting delegations from China and the exchanges of information, in addition to the NRDC program, which is very much set to help share best practices, can help China shorten that curve.
I agree with Felicia that the question of monitoring and reporting and verifying carbon emission reductions is going to be a real challenge. And like with many other issues in China, it has a political dimension, a technical dimension, and also a very important dimension of capacity. On the political side, I would say that the key issue in my mind of determining whether the provinces reach their goal of cutting their energy intensity by 2010, for example, is compromised by the fact that the same provincial government leaders responsible for meeting that target are responsible for reporting how well they've complied. So there's always a conflict of interest here. We understand, however, that the Chinese government has announced that there will be criminal penalties if it is revealed that these provincial officials have fudged the data. So it remains to be seen if that will, in fact, turn out that way. But China recognizes that serious problem and is taking steps to address it. But on the technical side, I'm reminded of a project that we worked on 5 or 6 years ago when we worked with the Ministry of Environmental Protection and four key provinces to develop a new method for reporting SO2 emissions from power plants. And we had a meeting with the head of the environmental protection officials of these four provinces after several months of fact-finding, and they were to report to the central government what were the total SO2 emissions from these power plants in their province. And I was pretty amazed to learn that the environmental protection officials had information for only the largest power plants. And for those power plants, they weren't actually measuring the levels of emissions. They were estimating them based on how much coal they were using. But for everything other than the largest power plants, they had no idea. So it's really a capacity issue. And even since that time today, we've had some very interesting discussions with a key U.S. Environmental Protection Administration official who's spending 6 months of the year working in China on this very issue, trying to strengthen China's capacity for measuring its CO2 emissions from power plants, but also its conventional pollutants. And he tells us that part of the problem is there's only, you know, two officials sitting in the room at the central government agency monitoring and going through paper records of these emissions, whereas just thousands of, you know, data points every day, whereas in the U.S., this is all computerized. And he also told a story about how these officials actually verify the data at the plant itself. You know, in the U.S., the officials have these portable calibration equipment at the site of the plant, and these canisters have to be calibrated every couple of days, or they'll go bad. But in China, they can't afford those, so they have a big canister of gas at their headquarter office, and they fill up the small cans, and then they carry that in the vehicle on the bouncy road to the site of the power plant. By the time it gets there, it's all out of whack. So it comes down to very specific problems like that that can be solved, but they have to be solved. So the key area for cooperation between the U.S. and China is, in my mind, not necessarily a question of dollars, but a question of capacity building. We have a tremendous amount of expertise on issues as simple as this that we have already been cooperating with China on and can do a lot more.
I can agree with Barbara Moore that the capacity building in China now is one of the way to address this climate change, the carbon issue. Why is that? As Barbara has said, and also it's openly announced, it's openly admitted by the China Academy of Environmental Planning that is affiliated to the MAP, the Ministry of Environmental Protection. It says the carbon pollution, you know, the carbon pollutants came out with the simultaneous with the conventional pollutants. So, and now I must be honest that China is also openly admit that the top priority facing, you know, top challenging facing Chinese people is pollution. And climate change is among the top three, but it's not as that imminent as harmful as pollution. But the optimistic side of this story, of this information, is that because these two problems come out from the same source at the same time. So when we address the conventional pollution problems, building up the capacity and help revising the law and to improving the enforcement system to strengthen rule of law, at the same time, we are addressing the climate issue at the same time.
We have some wonderful questions from the audience, and we want to try to get to as many, so I'm going to go into a lightning round, which means I'm going to address questions individually to some of the panelists, and if you can do so in a couple of minutes, that will help us to get to some of these wonderful audience questions. Gaojie, you went through China's education system. This is a long-term problem, and what is China's education system doing to prepare the next generation to live more sustainably in some ways, maybe not like us, maybe more like how they're doing now because they are consuming less than we are? Are there an active effort? What is happening in the education system on that issue?
I think from my observation, China's tradition is to live in a very modest way. I was told by my friend who is from Shanghai that when he was young, when the family is going to cook a fish, nothing was left, nothing was wasted, including the, you know, the skin. They will made it a cold dishy, and they will use the bone to fry it to make it like a snack. And everything, you know, this is the way Chinese people live, very modestly, because we are densely populated and not that much resources. But with, you know, in the passing 2 or 3 decades, with the opening and reforming policy and the economic development, and I think the cultural influence from the more developed or industrialized countries, China's young people became to, you know, not discard, you know, not inherited this tradition very well. And I think the education system now is trying to do, and we hope the education system doing more, is to teach our kids to live in a way sustainably, to change our old life behavior. I know my daughter is in the first grade of elementary school. Besides the, you know, the regular courses she's taking, she's also, you know, the teacher is also teaching the Asian, a very, how to say that, it's a historical, or in the Asian language, it's called Rule for the Students. And it teaches, it's basically the Confucius tradition, you know, education. And I'm very happy about that, and she's learning, you know, I did not get that education when I was young. That was after, right, that was the beginning of this, in early 80s, that was the, you know, Chinese is eager to open and to be the same as the rest of the world. Now China is thinking back to bring these good traditions to children. I think that's good. That's a good thing.
Unfortunately, we have come to that point in the program for our radio audience and for us to realize we have time for only one more question, even though we have a lot of wonderful questions from the audience, and I wish we could get to all of them. So I'm going to leave it to Peter to pick that one last question.
Yes, I think this is really one for all three of you, and it's very important to ask because you have been there on the ground, and you've seen the changes, especially Barbara, in over these decades. Not as someone that lives there, but someone who really poured out your, you know, sort of heart and soul into trying to make a difference there. You know, China has been so successful at energy efficiency and reducing energy use. You know, why weren't other pollutions, you know, catching up, or the reduction of which catching up as fast as energy efficiency's progress? And, you know, in those times, you know, even in the 2008 Olympics, there was all this discussion about, well, they need to make sure the air is clean, implying around the Olympics the air is generally not clean. So that question is, you know, there's been success and there's been problems, you know, of lagging. You know, what is the key to catch up overall, especially on climate change? And, you know, are there signs? Are you seeing, you know, the air in Shanghai and Beijing cleaner? You know, can you see the sun on more days now than when you started? And this goes for all of us, especially on the last one.
On this question, Peter, why don't we limit it to the one key thing that each person would like to share with us, okay, just very briefly, so that we will stay in touch with our radio audience. Felicia, can we start with you?
Oh, my goodness. I would just say I think there's something to be said for both opportunity and economic necessity. And so I think energy efficiency is something that has always made a lot of sense as an approach. Why it hasn't gotten further faster in the U.S. is a matter of some concern, but we're delighted because of the California energy efficiency success story that it's also become the basis for this administration's push towards climate and energy legislation, pulling them together. So there's a reason why energy is easier to latch onto as you think about it. My observations from my trips are that things have gotten worse as the economy and population has grown, but you've seen a more of a determination to deal with it, and there are also different tools and tactics, because in addition to the work we're doing out of our Beijing office, for example, on from a water pollution perspective, we do have a project working with a lot of the large American companies like Walmart, et cetera, to do a whole supply chain effort so that they'll require that all their suppliers in China up through the textile industry, which is a very polluting industry, have to be cleaner in order to meet purchasing standards. So we're also approaching it from that incentive point of view as opposed to a purely regulatory point of view.
Some days the air is cleaner in Beijing and Shanghai. Some days it's a lot worse. I think the one point I'd like everyone to realize that we shouldn't just look at China as if we're taking a snapshot. It's really a time release movie. And over the last 20 years that I've been working in China, I do see progress. It's not easy. It's not pretty. And there's a long way to go. But I would liken China's progress to, it's not like turning a car. It's like turning an ocean liner. It's slow and heavy. But just like the Titanic, a few degrees make a huge difference.
From my experience, I think I found the common concerns of both Chinese and U.S. people, and I also found the common interests. So I believe if we work together, we will have a better world for our children and the children's children.
Our thanks tonight to our panel on China at the Crossroads, Peter Lee, Felicia Marcus, Barbara Fenimore, and Guy Zhe, for coming and talking with us about the environmental changes and progress in China. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio. And now I'm Ann Clark, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.